will be on our website, kbu.fm/thegap. You can also, of course, search them up yourself. I find that we both found them to be pretty good reads, and some interesting perspectives on this kind of these kind of issues. And before we go, also want to mention that KBU is in the end of year drive right now. We are trying to raise $45,000 by December 31st, and we would love your support doing that. We are trying to have, you know, important conversations on this radio station, and we want to make it accessible to folks. And so that's, if you're into that, if you want to support that, you can go to kbu.fm/give or text KBU to 44321 to support us in this end of year drive. It makes a big difference for us.
Definitely. And we appreciate everyone and everything that you do for the community, and we are here to serve the community. Huge, huge thank you to Jill and Christopher for donating. It's really you that make us be. So I appreciate everything. If you want to donate again, that's kbo.fm/give or 44321, excuse me, or type in KBU to 44321 on your cellular devices. We are finished for the day. I hope that you just have a great one. Take care of yourselves and each other. We're all that we have, so, you know, we better get our stuff together. Thank you all so much. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
This has been The Gap. Happy birthday, Joe. Goodbye.
Girls, we run this.
This is Judy Berry from Earth First, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to non-commercial community radio, KBOO Portland. No compromise in defense of the truth.
Here goes nothing.
Tune in to KBOO for Drinking from Puddles, hosted by Brandon, every other Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m. That's Drinking for Puddles every other Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Yeah.
KBOO radio station is located in Portland, Oregon, in Multnomah County. We honor the indigenous people whose traditional and ancestral homelands we stand on. The Multnomah, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Tumwater, Watlala bands of the Chinook, the Tualatin, Kalapuya, and many other indigenous nations of the Willamette and Columbia River regions. It is important to acknowledge the ancestors of this land and to recognize that we are here because of the sacrifices forced upon them. In remembering these communities, we honor their legacy, their lives, and their descendants with the forming of relationship to each other and the living world. We establish and support harmony within ourselves and set the stage for praxis.
And welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a national audience produced at a different location every week. Hey, I'm Nick Espinoza of the Deep Dive Radio Show, where we talk about all things cybersecurity, cyber warfare, and technology related, broadcasting out of the Chicagoland area on WHIW 101.3 FM. And today, I have an insanely special guest. One, I don't even need to interview, or rather, I should say that. One, I actually really don't need to introduce, and that's what I meant to say here. You can tell I'm a little freaked out and nervous. This is like meeting Santa. I was a kid at Christmas just before this interview. I'm not kidding. But with me today is Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson. So, Dr. Tyson, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, Dr. Neil to you.
Dr. Neil it is. All right, Dr. Neil. Fair enough. And I'm just
Neil is fine. Plus, I'd like to contrast whatever you'd feel meeting Santa with me, and at least say that I actually exist.
well, don't tell that to the 7-year-olds in the world. That's what I was thinking of. Like, just kidding.
I exist, but I'm not bringing you presents.
Fair enough. This is my present for the year. Really, it is. So I want to dive in, and first things first. And I really honestly hate to start with a serious question out of the gate, but I know that my listeners are really dying to understand this and really dying to know this. Star Trek or Star Wars? Because I know you're a fan.
Star Trek.
Star Trek? All right. Next question. All right. We can now continue this interview. Now,
there's at least some premise of actual science going on in Star Trek. There's at least some thought that went into the physics, the chemistry, the biology, the reasoning, the logic. There's some thread through every episode, and I've yet to find any such corresponding threads in Star Wars. So to me, Star Wars is you know, yes, it's a fight between good and evil that happens to take place in space, not because it actually needed to be there.
Fair enough. And that's a great answer, too. And obviously, I'm a fan of Star Trek, so you had the right answer on that one as well. But that's good to know. That's good to know. Thank you. I think one of those interesting things that you mentioned in your lecture in Chicago, and it's something that I think we take for granted, which is essentially in the vein of my first question, is that you mentioned that because of Albert Einstein's just amazing work, we've been able to create, by virtue of that, basically standing on his shoulders, more future Nobel Prize-winning innovations like lasers. And, you know, recently, you know, we discovered the Higgs boson in the last, I believe, decade or so. And so basically, science and technology, from what I understand, builds upon itself to improve over time. And lately, obviously, with the microprocessor, we've been accelerating that growth vastly. So my question to you is, are there any limitations here, if any? Like, what could stunt the growth or impede our progress as humanity just continues to innovate? And I'm very curious to know if you think there is a limit to, you know, to what we can achieve.
Yeah, I'm not going to be the one who you look back on and say, oh, look how stupid he was. He thought we were at the limits of our understanding. I'm not going to be that guy. I'm not going to say that there are limits. What I will say is that, yes, there are limits to microcircuitry, all right? If you have electrical pathways that are sufficiently small and near each other, because the miniaturization of electronics is an important feature of what it is to make them fast, something that eluded any futurist from the 1960s, such as the concept of HAL in the movie 2001, the idea was, okay, if powerful computers are big, then really powerful computers are even bigger. Right, so there's HAL occupying this whole section of the ship with this microprocessor, and it's like, no, that's not how you make a computer fast, because the travel time of electrical circuitry through it can actually significantly impede calculations that happen at a very rapid rate. So the point is, if you miniaturize it too much, what happens is the quantum wavelength of the electrons in the circuit end up sharing a quantum state with electrons in an adjacent circuit. And you can't have that. They need to be completely insulated from each other. So there's a physical limit to how small you can make this before the entire microcircuitry gets completely scrambled by quantum coherence. And so a side branch of that is just quantum computing, where, you know, you have bits. Your audience probably is familiar with this. Your bits, and all of computing is binary, zeros and ones.
Right.
So the quantum computer exploits the fact that in quantum physics, you don't have that level of certain information about anything, that there's a probability that an entity is one value or another. And so it's called the superposition. So you can have the superposition of a bit having the value of zero or having the value of one. And that superposition means it can be any value in between,
right?
Okay? Statistically, any value in between. And so we call those qubits, right? Q-U-B-I-T-S. So quantum computing exploits the very real quantum nature of the universe in the circuitry itself. So that would be an important leap over the computing that we're doing now. But what we don't know is, might something be discovered in this century or the next that's a whole entire new other thing that exploits a new feature of the natural universe? I'm making this up, but maybe dark matter and dark energy, once we know what it is, that will empower us to do a whole other thing and open a whole other economy. In the same way quantum physics, discovered a century ago, opened the entire world of the information technology universe. There's no creation, storage, and retrieval of information, digital information, without the quantum, that front and center in how and why that works. So I'm not given reason to presume somehow we're at the end of things. And given that dark matter and dark energy are 95% of all that is driving this universe, and we don't know what's causing it, it really doesn't sound like we're on top of the situation. So I'm going with, yeah, there's probably more to come.
Fair enough. And I would agree with you. I mean, I believe we will continue to progress as humans. I mean, that's just in our nature. We want to explore, whatever exploration means, you know, to whoever's doing the exploring. But in the vein of my last question, one of the things that I'm actually driving at, because it's actually part of my day job, is that we've really seen a rise of anti-science and anti-education in the past few years. We have a huge amount of misinformation and disinformation that appears to be rampant online. So now we have to contend with, let's say, progress or anti-progress in things like vaccines. We have vaccine hesitancy. We see baseless conspiracy theories. Even the term research seems to be co-opted by certain people. And studies are showing that people are trusting like a Facebook friend posting whatever they're posting more than the due diligence that science analysis or scientific analysis is paying to verify information and putting it out in the public sphere. So in that sense, what do you think is the biggest issue we have in that context?
So let me be a mild devil's advocate here and suggest that maybe anti-science is not on a rise or at an all-time high. It may be, but let me just offer another explanation here. It could be that such people were always out there. And now with social media and the internet, they can find each other and they can band together. And so they can have a louder collective voice than any one of them could have had as individuals. But I don't know if there are more, if you're counting absolute numbers today than in the past, or more as a fraction of the public. That's my first comment. Second, it's clear that if you have a full-grown adult who thinks Earth is flat, that's evidence of, I think, two things in this world. One, that we live in a country that protects free speech. So there you go. And another, that we have a failure in the educational pipeline, where people don't really know or understand what science is and how and why it works. So science, I think, has been taught, oh, here's a textbook, learn this, you get tested on it, and we're done. And nowhere is there the lingering understanding that science is a way of querying nature with methods and tools exquisitely tuned to prevent you from thinking something is true that is not, or from thinking something that is not true that is. And absent that training, you are susceptible to all manner of forces out there, leaving you to think that practically anything can be true just because it feels good to think so. Mm. So I don't know if these people have to age out and the next generation with a curriculum that does right by science takes over. I do know that the next generation is very climate change woke, and that means they're listening to the scientists. They have only known life with a smartphone, and they know intuitively that a smartphone is enabled by countless thousands of science and engineering marvels that enable them to do everything they can. And I have to remind my daughter, for example, that, oh, by the way, you know, your smartphone is also a telephone. We can call each other.
Right.
Have you considered that?
What?
What a concept.
Right, exactly, exactly.
So I think it's quite a challenge, and I can ask it another way. If this landscape of science educators did not exist, and I'm a part of that landscape, as are you, maybe it would all be worse. So it's not that we're bad at our jobs. It's that we're not appreciating how much better things are for the work that we're doing. That's, of course, a self-serving comment. But to all of us who are out there in the blogosphere and you know, YouTubers and Instagrammers, there are a lot of science educators out there who are doing homespun, interesting science experiments that are intriguing and have great personalities. And so I think you have to keep trying.
Yeah, no, and I would agree. I mean, and I would say of my own audience, those that are interested in the sciences and, you know, listening to people like you.
Pre-sorted for you, yes.
Yeah, you know, so it's a great audience to reach. But, you know, as I'm looking at this, though, I mean, I you're also sitting on a radio show that actually interviewed one of the leaders of the Flat Earth movement like a year and a half ago to talk specifically about, if social media didn't exist, you would still be like 12 people in a newsletter not finding each other. you know, and it was an interesting conversation to see them. And my fear always with this is that, you know, as they put a rather loud voice out there, they continue to attract people that are simply not reading in, or they've got a friend that says, oh yeah, oh, this makes sense. And
again, this is a free country. We're not here to control your thoughts. So it's there are plenty of jobs for you in this world if you think Earth is flat. Okay? What you want to do is keep people like that away from becoming head of NASA, for example. That could be a major regressive force in civilization and in our culture. So I don't know if it's actually more, but it's no less of a challenge for educators who are out there to address this misthinking. People don't know what data are. They don't know what it means to be an expert. An expert is just whoever tells them something convincingly, rather than looking at. By the way, advertisers know this, right? Advertisers don't just show data and say, here's why this car is better. It's better on all these tables and all these graphs. No, they get somebody, wow, that car is amazing. I was able to do everything I want. And you're hearing the person, the testimony, without regard to the person's expertise, what they know. Maybe they don't know anything about cars, but you don't care because it's another human being sharing their emotional reaction to something that you then define to be the new truth. And it's a shortcoming of our capacity, shortcoming of our interactions with others. Okay. It's why we invented science, to bypass that.
And I think that's a really good point. And in that vein, I actually have another question that is actually really similar, but it has to relate with science and actually what we just saw in Afghanistan with regime change. And the reason why I say this is I actually did my fourth TED Talk on that subject, on the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan and the privacy.
Fourth TED Talk?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I love them.
Okay.
They're fun. Yeah, literally last week. It'll be out shortly. And
well, congratulations. Uh-huh.
Thank
Very
you.
Important
Thank
platform.
You.
Yes.
Yeah, I love it. And I think everybody should, you know, engage in it whatever way, whether you're listening or participating, whatever it is. I think it's a fantastic platform that's put out for the world, and I'm very happy I'm able to do those. But basically, I talked about the Taliban takeover as it spells problems for their very heavily data mined population, and I'm going to science with this. Trust me on this, because it seems like having an identity system outside of a government control would actually help quell the threat of having the information you post online be used against you by, let's say, a sudden regime change like the Taliban taking over. And I don't think they're going to be the only country to experience that as we see democracy under threat. And what do you see in this current political climate in the West as the biggest threat to the national scientific institutions that could possibly go through government change? What if, as you mentioned, you know, we have free speech in this country, what if suddenly we didn't? Like, what would the research that science is doing, would it purely be a weaponization of things, or would something else that we'd have to be concerned about as we are going through this? And a lot of people obviously are concerned for democracy in the United States, as well as, you know, Europe, as we're seeing authoritarians attempt to rise. So I'm just curious to know what your thoughts are on that.
A couple of things. I think we overcredit free speech for so many things that we enjoy as Americans that actually have nothing to do with free speech.
Okay.
So, for example, Russia beat us in practically every metric of space exploration until we landed on the moon. It's not a democracy. No, it's not. And they don't have free speech. Mm-hmm. And they're not free in the way that we valued here in the United States. Yet they were kicking our buttocks in technological advances. And so we like to think of free speech as something that promotes science and engineering, whereas our educational systems show up very low on international rankings of how well we do in our science and math basics coming through, you know, kindergarten through 12th grade. Not only that, China has the world's largest radio telescope right now, and ours just crumbled into dust, the Arecibo telescope. Look it up on YouTube. You can watch it collapse in real time. This was the largest telescope in the world for 60 years or so. And China now has it, so that aliens trying to talk to Earthlings, their first contact will be Chinese astrophysicists. Not only that, China has the record for the farthest distance between two quantum entangled particles. Hmm. Right? Oh, but they have human rights violations, and there's not really free speech, and there's authoritarian, and is it a dictator or is it a lead? How do you? So these systems are very different from us, yet it's not stopping their advances at all. England, with a monarchy, made all manner of advances in science and technology coming out of the 17th and into the 18th century. A lot of it was militaristically motivated, of course, as you had hinted, but or said explicitly. But so just because we have free speech is not alone the thing that makes this happen. What makes it happen is you need a system of government that cares about discovery, whatever is motivating them. And most of the time it's war, but it could also be economics. And it could be just because it's kind of cool, all right? Right. The kind of cool money funded the Hubble telescope, right. All right? That itself didn't have security value, although it was based on a previous model that did, all right? There were Hubble telescopes in orbit pointing down before the Hubble telescope that we know and love pointed up. Mm. So now, that being said, let me make a difference. You need free exchange of scientific ideas. That's an aspect of free speech, right? But I don't think that's what people think of when they think of free speech. They think of you're out in the open and you want to say whatever you want. That's different from when I publish something, does everyone have access to it? Science cannot productively move forward without that kind of openness of what is discovered. And you could close it all off if it's secret or top secret security. You could do that, sure, but you won't get the benefit of others who might be working on the same thing that could advance your results even faster or further. So science is a free and open exchange of ideas. That's how it works. If you go back 1,000 years to the Middle East, Baghdad, right in the center of the golden age of Islam, you can say, well, what made that period in location and time so special? Well, Baghdad was a major trading center. And so Christians and Muslims and Jews and atheists, although I don't know how, there might have been a different word for the non-believer back then. But anyway, everyone moved through those places, and there was a big and beautiful library there. So it became a place where you'd exchange ideas, you would contest ideas. And if you do that in a way without killing each other, every idea you have, if someone thought about it more than you, it rapidly advances. And faster than if you're sitting at home alone in your armchair. And so great advances in engineering, astronomy, medicine, and especially mathematics rose up out of that period. Point is, you can't just cite, we are humans, it's in our DNA to explore, as a permanent and eternal reality among humans, because the countries that actually do it, first, it's not all countries, it's only a very select subset, and not all countries do it for all of time. And so you really have to look at the cultural, political constructs of those times and places to see what it was that was valued by the leaders, by the electorate, or whoever was in charge of running the place. Mm. And was exploration and discovery a fundamental part of their portfolio? Because if it wasn't, they would then be dancing to the tunes played by others, or just simply regressing back into the cave. Because that's where you go if you stop advancing.
Right. Well, and that makes a lot of sense. I mean, and even in your book, Accessory to War, which I thought was just really interesting, you know, you mentioned that both Archimedes and Leonardo would have basically worked for their departments of defense, right? When the telescope came about, it was an immediate instrument of war. And so there is, I think, in one aspect, as I was talking about, the militarization of that. But yes, if you have the time, the money, the energy, and the effort, and a government that really says, yeah, we want to do this, we want to get to the moon in a decade, you know, you can do it. You just have to have the effort for that. And I think that's just...
Yeah, but let me important. Just be clear. When we said, let's go to the moon in the decade, we had just witnessed the Soviet Union just beat us at every, get to space first. So this was a reactive posture that we took, not a proactive posture.
Right.
I have no doubt that if Russia were not threatening us, the godless commies, right? If they weren't threatening us, then we wouldn't have gone anywhere. We're not that organized. We're not that coherent in our responses,
right,
to do things just because some fraction of the country wants to do it. But when everybody feels threatened, your way of life and all the rest, which is how communism was portrayed as the great threat to democracy and to freedom and to peace-loving nations around the world, then we responded. So all the front-end rhetoric, we'll do it not because it's easy, but because it's hard. No task will be so. And it was stirring rhetoric. But you part the curtains, and behind there is, we're at war. Congress, please write the checks, okay? Because we need this in order to maintain our self-image that we are better than they are at everything.
Right.
You need that as the backdrop. It's not just the speech. The whole landscape has to support it. And like I said, in some other research I'd done, appeared in a different volume, in the Space Chronicles book, it's either war or money. These are the two big drivers of doing very expensive things. The urge to explore and discover, I've never seen that win out over anything. It typically piggybacks the other exercises.
Right. Well, and even the discovery of America was for wealth.
Yeah, exactly. It was a shorter route to the Far East.
Exactly.
So Columbus is looking for India, and he calls the new people he meets Indians. Right.
That's his thing.
if it weren't so tragic, it would be completely hilarious that this is how history played out. Right.
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
The motivation, this was not, Columbus did that before the Dutch East India Trading Company went around and made a buck, by the way.
Yeah.
Because they would then learn where the trade winds, where are the hostels, where are the friendlies, is there food there, what is there a marketplace? So the governments did things for hegemonistic reasons, geopolitical reasons.
Right.
And so let's be honest with ourselves about that. That's why no one's going to Mars, unless we feel threatened by someone else who is.
Right, right. And you mentioned that as well, in your lecture in Chicago, which I thought was great. And just looking at the time, and I wish I had 3 hours with you, but I don't. I'd like to talk about your latest book, A Brief Welcome to the Universe, Pocket Size Edition. And can you explain to my audience all about that? Because I mean, you're writing.
Yeah. So I have two co-authors on it, Michael Strauss and J. Richard Gott III. The three of us co-taught an introductory astrophysics class at Princeton University back when I was on the faculty there, and we really didn't want to teach the class because we had other things we wanted to do, but the class had to be taught. So we stapled ourselves together. And because then we only have to teach a third of the class. So it was part laziness, but also part we taught the subjects that we were most enthusiastic about. Well, that's how we divided the universe. But we also did another thing. Instead of following a traditional curriculum, we just picked the coolest stuff we can think of in the universe and put that in the course. And then we were invited to write a textbook, which we did, but it was still kind of very conversational and very, here's cool, here's another cool thing, I'll tell you that. And this one intrigued me, I'll tell you that. All right. And we wrote the textbook. And by the way, it has math in it. All right. But then the publisher, Princeton Press, said, maybe this could, we can get a pocket size version of this. So here we have a course that we taught where we taught only our favorite stuff. And that's what ended up in the textbook. And now we cherry-picked the textbook to put what's in the pocket-sized edition. And this is intensely, the book is, it has a level of enthusiastic intensity that may be rare in science books, just because it's the stuff we love the most, and you are going to benefit from that if you check it out. So that's what it just came out just this month.
Yeah, no, and I think that's great. And I know you always have stuff that's going on, and your writing is just absolutely fantastic. For those of my listeners or viewers that haven't read any of your books, I highly recommend picking them up, you know, including the new ones. They're really approachable. And I think, honestly, that's one of those things that I just absolutely love about you. When I'm listening to you, or, you know, listening to Star Talk, or, you know, whatever it is, I really do believe that when it comes to bringing science awareness to the general public, I'm not kidding. I think you are going to be the shoulders that others will stand on in the future. You are priming, I think, science.
Is that why my shoulders are kind of droopy lately?
Yeah, a little bit. But Neil, Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson, thank you so much for joining me today. And if anybody wants to follow you or you know, connect with you in some way, shape, or form on social media, what's the best way they can do that?
Yeah, it's all Neil deGrasse Tyson, you know, at Neil deGrasse Tyson, D-E-G-R-A-S-S-E, a silent E, except on Twitter, where back in the birth of Twitter, you only had 140 characters. And I said, I'm not blowing a whole 8 characters on my middle name here, or however many characters, E-G-R-A-S-S-E, 7 characters. So it's Neil Tyson, at Neil Tyson on Twitter, where most of my communication with the public occurs when I'm not otherwise in the Chicago theater.
Right. And thank you. I knew we were the first on your tour, so I was very proud of that fact. But thank you again, and this has just absolutely been great. Thank you.
You got it. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That's it for Sprouts. You have been listening to the Deep Dive Radio Show with Nick Espinoza. The Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the country. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. Thanks to Brian David at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to showcase nationally on Sprouts, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg. Her email is ursula@pacifica.org. I'm Nick Espinoza here in Chicago. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next week on Sprouts.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Good morning, this is Disability Justice, an everyday pursuit and survival. Your host, John Griffiths.
This is Dina Wilder, the behind the scenes editor, and I'm going to just explain a little bit about what's going to be happening. Today, we are going to share part 3 of 2021 Build a Movement, which occurred on November 12th. In this episode of Build a Movement, or affectionately known as BAM, Alan Hines and Nico Serra are the facilitators. Alan Hines is the Housing Access Director of Community Vision and the Director of Real Choice Initiative, and Nico Serra is a very active disability activist.
Before we begin a recap of Build a Movement, I'd like to remind you that KBOO is needing to get back on a good financial track. We did not reach our goal of $45,000 during our last drive, so we really need your support to keep programs like ours on the air. Support this end of the year drive by going to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. We will start by recapping what happened in Build a Movement 1. So listen now into Build a Movement 2021.
So John, this is your moment, my friend. We want to spend a moment with you to learn about BAM.
Like I said, Build a Movement is just an effort to get more and more and more and more people involved. And when I say more people involved, I mean people with intellectual disabilities, people with physical disabilities who have many of the same issues, that people with intellectual disabilities have. The people behind those people, like, you know, all the caregivers, their PAs, their case managers, because the larger the net I throw, the more people who show up here, the more they keep on thinking, that's a large number. Maybe I should start taking some kind of action on their behalf because I want to get voted in next time I'm up for re-election. And that's the intent behind Build a Movement.
Now let's talk about cross-disability organizing. And this is what John was talking about when he said he started BAM and he wanted to get a lot of people involved. We are going to probably talk more about ways that we can organize with people around us, whether they're a part of the IDD community or they're part of one of the other disability communities.
So in Build a Movement 1 and 2, there was lots of discussion about what cross-disability movement is. In Build a Movement 3, we invited legislators to come and listen to our voices. We begin part 3 with Nico introducing the different legislators that attended.
We're so grateful for all the legislators that have shown up today and assistants from the offices that have showed up today to listen to us tell our group stories. We're gonna go into breakout rooms here in a minute so that people can tell you their individual stories because we have tons of individual stories.
No problem at all. Hi, I'm Zach Hudson. I represent part of East Multnomah County, including Troutdale, Fairview, Wood Village, and Gresham. And I recognize some of you before from having met you, so it's great to see you again. I work as a special education teacher. This year I'm at Tumwater Middle School in Oregon City. And I love what you've come together to present us today.
All right. Representative Barbara Smith Warner, will you say hello and whatever you like?
Thank you so much. Hi, everybody. I'm just excited to be here. I'm Barbara Smith Warner. I represent also East Side, but a little further in than Zach does. My district goes, if you think about a map of Portland, my district goes from about 24th to about 141st. And then it's like, if you think of where I-84 is, it's north of that and then south of around Prescott. So I've got everything from Grant Park all the way out to Park Rose, including Maywood Park, which is a city that is fully incorporated within the boundaries of the city of Portland, which is something I never knew until I became a legislator and started representing Maywood Park out there. So, and I'm happy to be here. When I got this invitation, I was so excited because the last in-person event that you guys did, I'm pretty sure, was in my district up at the Rose City United Methodist Church, I believe. And I'd remember it was a day very much like this. It was cold and rainy. And we all met in the basement of that church, and it was such a great event, such a great way to really see and hear everybody's stories. It was fantastic. So I was really, when I got the invitation, I was like, oh yeah, I'm coming to that again. So thanks for having me.
Awesome. Okay, we got Lauren Morrison, is that correct?
Yes, it is, thank you. I'm here on behalf of Representative Dexter, who is working in the hospital today. And she represents House District 33, which is Northwest Multnomah County and Northeast Washington County. So a little bit of the Pearl District, a little bit of Cedar Mill, and then all the way to Bethany. And I'm glad to be here today. It's nice to see some familiar faces. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Lauren. Representative Rob News. Hi.
Hi, Nico. Hi, Alan. Hello, everyone else. I know that Nico and Alan are my constituents, though, so at least you used to be. I don't know if you moved. Delighted to be here and hear about the things that you all are experiencing, both good and bad, and what you think you need the state or maybe the federal government in partnership with the state to step up and do so that you can have more fulfilling, more meaningful, more independent lives. So thank you for your advocacy and what you do. It's always important for us legislators to hear from people that are actually utilizing benefiting or sometimes have challenges with the programs and the services that we help to fund and put in place. So.
Cool. Thank you so much, Representative. Then we've got Emerson from Representative Hudson's office, it looks like.
Yes, I'm also very happy to be here, but I think Rep. Hudson really covered everything that, I would have said about House District 49. So yeah, just excited to learn more.
Okay, did we get everybody? Oh, Ryan from Representative Reardon's office.
There it goes. Okay. Hey, everyone. Rep. Reardon sends his apologies. He wish he could have made it because this is a big deal for him. I know he always enjoys meeting with folks, and I see a couple folks I've seen in the office a few times now. Yeah. So it's good to see you again over Zoom. Just really grateful for the opportunity to talk to everyone today. And looking forward to hearing a little bit more.
Thank you so much, Ryan. So we've been collectively talking about how we all have individual stories and that those stories are powerful, and they're also very similar to stories with our peers and other people who don't even think of being one of us, but they have the same stories too. And so we've been working on developing our group story. So what we're gonna do first is we're gonna talk about our group stories around housing. So this first one is, we need more accessible, affordable, good quality housing so we can live full lives and visit one another. So if you've ever been in a situation where you have struggled with accessible, affordable, good quality housing, or had a hard time visiting somebody that maybe uses a wheelchair or something and they can't leave, if that's something that you've ever experienced, that you've lived in housing that hasn't been great, or you know other people that have lived in housing that's been hard. Yeah, there we go. I see people doing some thumbs up. So raise your hand if you or someone you know has struggled with this, finding affordable, accessible, good quality housing. Is that something that you've dealt with? Yeah, that's several people right there. Okay, so the next one. It's too difficult to afford rent for people who live on Social Security. We need more options. So do people who are navigating the eligibility process. So people who haven't won their Social Security cases yet, or maybe haven't done their functional exam yet, they don't get to their services. So if you've ever had this happen for you or someone you know, where you couldn't afford your rent on your Social Security alone, has that ever happened to you, where you struggled to pay your rent? Because I'm seeing some head nods. Okay, the next one here says, housing and in-home care are very important issues to us. Both are closely related to and critical for successfully living independently. So if you've ever had a hard time getting your housing and your in-home care set up so that you can live independently, I've definitely experienced that. And that would be for folks that have ever had to live in institutions. Activation alert, sorry, if you've ever had to live in an institution, this is you, yeah. So we see some people saying yes, yeah. All right, so those are just a few of our group stories. We have many, many group stories and not enough time to tell all of them. So we're gonna move into our next group of talking points. And I should give you a little background here. So BAM has been meeting for 5 years now. And over these 5 years, we've identified three areas that we focus on. The first one is what we just talked about, housing. The second one that we're gonna talk about now is about services. And the last one is about healthcare. So now we're gonna talk about services. Okay, the caregiver workforce crisis impacts many parts of our daily lives. One major impact is it makes it difficult to live independently without the care worker support you need. We feel that there must be more done to confront the caregiver crisis and support of our integration. So go ahead and raise your hand if you've ever had a hard time getting through your daily life because you didn't have enough care worker support. Okay, here's the next group story. We need more case managers to support us and our care providers. We also need more care providers in general. Yeah. So if you've ever had a hard time getting in touch with your caseworker when you need to, or your worker hasn't been paid when they need to on time. Yeah, I see some hands going up here. All right, number three here. And now we're gonna move into the last priority of the three issues for BAM, and that is about healthcare. And here we go. The first one says, accessible healthcare is important to us because we deserve to live lives without being in pain. Have you ever found yourself, you or someone you know, being in pain because they couldn't get the healthcare they needed when they needed it? Go ahead and raise your hand or do a thumbs up. Yeah. Yeah, this is going to be a story. I bet a lot of people have this story. Our medical providers should be in charge of our decisions, right? Us and our medical providers together, we make decisions together. Not somebody at an insurance company who's not an expert on health or human bodies. Find it, yeah. Have you ever had weird denials when you and your doctor both agree you need something, but somebody at a desk at an insurance company that doesn't know anything about the human body says you can't have it? Has that ever happened to you? Getting your wheelchairs repaired, I know that's a big one. Yeah, where you need a medication and you can't get it when you need it. Yeah. All right. So part of what we're hoping to share here with all of the legislators and the representatives coming from the legislative offices is that, again, we have a lot of very common barriers, even though we're split up into 10 different groups of based on our disabilities. And we, as a Build a Movement in our fifth year here, are getting in this Zoom room and saying, you know what, there's a bigger story here. If we can tell our bigger story, maybe our representatives can understand better. We are experiencing barriers. Here we are 30 years after the ADA passed. We're still experiencing barriers that are really frustrating and difficult and totally mess up the quality of our lives and our days. And we would really like to change those things.
You are listening to Disability Justice. I want to take a moment to tell you that KBOO is in the middle of their end of year drive. Please go to kboo.fm/give. By donating, you are giving a voice to those that have no voice and helping us get the word out about our constant struggles in just staying alive for another day.
And back to Build a Movement 3.
All right, so we did our group story, and now it's time to start getting into telling your individual stories. And we can take volunteers and just roll with it as we go, and all we need to do is just make sure we wait until one person ends before we start. And I think this is gonna be great. Let's see if we have it. It looks like Ross wants to volunteer to go first. And remember, we're gonna talk about our stories with housing, healthcare, and services. And go ahead, Ross, you wanna go first?
Yes, I live in Mount Angel, and the rent is rather high. And because I make too much money, and I have SSDI, so I do not qualify for any of the Section 8 HUD and any of those.
Thank you for sharing, Ross. Sue, do you feel like sharing?
Yeah. Well, I am deaf myself, but I work as an advocate with Independent Living Resources. We are a referral source, and we do advocacy for people with disabilities. And it has been, through the pandemic, even prior, but especially through the pandemic, it has been exhausting as a counselor. So it's frustrating. It's frustrating not only for our consumers, but it's frustrating as a counselor to try to get people resources, and they're not out there. Housing is a big one. There are very long waiting lists for subsidized housing. People that are on SSI only get 700 and something a month, some even less, and they're expected to be able to pay rent. Food stamps, they only get so much And that's not enough to carry them through the month, especially with the cost of everything going up. So we're scrambling for food pantries, looking for resources, even for Thanksgiving. They opened up a couple places for Thanksgiving dinner, and they were closed in a matter of a couple days. So people are not able to get the dinners that they're looking for. So they have to go, instead of being able to get a dinner and bring home, they're going to have to go out to shelters or whatever if they want to get a nice Thanksgiving dinner. Healthcare, really, really difficult. People are scrambling to try to get doctor's appointments, but then they can't get to the doctor's appointments. We're fighting with Medicaid case managers on providing transportation. It just gets very convoluted. Home care workers, a lot of them are not working any longer because of the pandemic, or they're quitting because they don't want to get vaccinated, or the pay is low and the state is not paying what it needs to be paying for these people to be able to afford a cost of living. So the disabled community is really sort of at the low rung on the totem pole or the ladder in being able to get the services they need. And I have people on the phone with me all the time, literally crying because they feel they're going to be evicted, they're going to be homeless, there's no place for them to go. People that have children and they're disabled, it's just really, really overwhelming. And I feel the state is lacking in looking at the disabled as a group and being able to do something for them. It seems like, you know, they're looking at other groups, but the disabled are at the bottom of the rung. And so that's just been very frustrating.
Thank you so much for sharing all of that, Sue, and bringing your experience of working with people with disability.
Welcome.
In addition to being a person with disabilities yourself, thank you. Alan has requested to go next, and I'm gonna do communications.
Right, well, for myself.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Sue, finish. Did you say you wanted to add something else?
Well, for myself, I'll just give you something that I'm going through for myself. I wear cochlear implants. And the cochlear implants that I use, the company is going to stop manufacturing those implants. I will no longer be able to get parts. I will no longer be able to use those implants if something goes wrong next year. So I'm being told I have to buy new implants. However, my insurance will not cover them. And for two implants, it's $5,000. So I have to scramble and try to figure out. I work, so I'm not eligible for Medicaid, which would cover them. But I'm trying to scramble and figure out how I'm gonna have to take out a loan or something to pay for these implants. And as a disabled person, this is a necessity for me to be able to work, to thrive, to do what I need to do in life. So it's very frustrating on a personal level for me that I need these devices and I'm being told I have to pay for them myself, which is absolutely asinine. So that's just on a personal level, aside from everything else.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Sue. I really appreciate you sharing your story and vulnerable.
Okay.
Sorry you're going through that. Thank you. Alan has requested to go next. Alan says, I want to second what Sue was just talking about. Alan said, I am the Housing Access Director at Community Vision. And we support people with disabilities to find housing in the communities.
I work every day with housing lists.
And I look every day through these housing lists.
The waitlist length is pretty ridiculous.
And the waitlist lengths are pretty ridiculous.
And I think as a community, the majority of us live on just
I think as a community in general, we live on Social Security.
And it's almost impossible to be able to do that.
And it's almost impossible to do that, to live off of Social Security and rent your own place.
So I see this crisis.
I see a crisis coming.
that is when parents of disability people start being unable to take care of them.
And that crisis I see coming is the parents of people with disabilities are getting older, and when the time comes when they can't care for their children anymore, children with disabilities.
Has to preserve the number of children living with disabilities has increased decades.
Oh, Alan said for the last 2 to 3 decades, the number of people with disabilities living with their parents has drastically increased. And the supports that are in place to help people continue living independently have not kept pace.
Yeah, I know there's a lot of different things that go into that.
I know that there's a lot of different things to go into that.
But to be concrete right now.
To be concrete right now.
There is a lot of it. I am finally going to the Build Back Better plan.
There is a lot of funding going into the Build Back Better plan.
For
caregiving.
And
we really need that funding to happen.
And we need it to come down to us.
And we need that to come down to us.
And support caregiving.
To support caregiver wages. And increasing housing options for people with disabilities.
And lots of other things.
Lots of other things. It, in the richest country in the history of humanity, it should be better for everyone. And I think that all of the people who have shown up here, you all get it. I think that you probably get it, although I don't know everyone. But I want to say, like, on a personal note, in support of what Sue was saying, like, I have had, I didn't even know this was a thing, dental disability, where you can't chew your own food because you can get your teeth extracted for free. But if you want to get a root canal or an implant or something like that, you have to pay out of pocket for it. And I'm being told I have to come up with, I think it's $17,000 cash or credit card to pay for that. And I can't qualify for a credit card because I'm primarily on disability. And so when we say the $700, $800 a month, that's, I don't even crack $8,000 a year on that. So it's our communities are profoundly impacted by poverty. And we all have a million stories and not enough time to tell them.
And we will have to end it there, but we will pick it up next month, finishing off listening to individual stories that people gave to legislators during Build a Movement 3. This is Dina Wilder, the editor for Disability Justice. We are in our end of the year drive. KBOO is trying to acquire $45,000 by December 31st. 80% of KBOO's income is from listeners like you. Donate to kboo.fm/give. Spread the word by going on social media.
That's the end of Disability Justice. Since we cannot be fully aware of everybody's difficulties within the community, we would really like it if you would send us your email, disabilityjustice@kboo.org.
Hi, welcome to Food Sleuth Radio, where we help you think beyond your plate. I'm Melinda Hemelgarn, a registered dietitian and investigative nutritionist on a mission to connect the dots between